Good afternoon. I'll call the first case for the, first and only case for the afternoon, 06AP 1153, 06AP 1974, Acuity versus Kitchen. Is it Bagadia?
I believe it's Bagadia.
Bagadia. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Arthur Simpson representing Acuity. Good seeing you back, sir.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Arthur Simpson appearing for Acuity. What I'd like to do this afternoon is to first start with a very short summary of the facts and the court opinions and decisions that have brought us here. Secondly, I'd like to provide an outline of what I think are the most pertinent issues. There are a potpourri of issues in this matter, but I think there are a much smaller group we can actually focus upon. And then lastly, of course, I'd like to address our position with respect to those issues. By way of brief introduction, this all began in the state of Oregon. There was a lawsuit by Symantec, which I'm referring to generically. There's a company called Quarterdeck involved with them as well. Symantec filed a suit against a Mr. Webb and Mr. Webb's corporation regarding sale of unauthorized software. As a part of that process, Symantec learned that they had issues with a gentleman named Bagadia and his corporation, which was Unique Corporation, acronym UNIK. They filed suit against Mr. Bagadia and Unique in Oregon. Mr. Bagadia was dismissed due to lack of jurisdiction. Summary judgment was entered for some $950,000, I believe, in the Oregon action. A written decision by the federal court was set forth stating the basis for the opinion. While that litigation was proceeding, Acuity, which had an insurance policy with Unique and Bagadia, filed a declaratory judgment action in Waukesha County Circuit Court here in Wisconsin for a declaration as to whether there was a duty to defend this action. Secondly, subsequently, whether there was a duty to indemnify. The trial court found a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify, as was discussed in the briefs. I will not go into all the details of the rulings. The matter then went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals issued a published decision, and I thought there were four key points from that, at least in my mind. Number one, right in the very beginning of the decision, the Court of Appeals referred to this as a case of pirated software. I think that's important because that's, I believe it's paragraph one or paragraph two of the decision. I believe it's important because that really is what this case is about, and whether pirated software can somehow translate into advertising injury under a CGL, also known as a comprehensive general liability policy.
Isn't this case really just about a contract?
Which contract?
The insurance contract, the policy.
Well, it's about the contract and how the facts are applied to the contract. I mean, I agree with you that we have to look at the three elements as set forth in the Fireman's Fund decision, which I'll come to in discussing this, but you have to have underlying facts to see how they apply to the contract. In a vacuum, the contract is really meaningless to coming to a decision without looking at exactly what happened here out in Oregon, because that's what the question is, at this point, whether there's a duty to indemnify with respect to the Oregon action. So we have to know what happened out there by way of background.
Just a matter of focus, I guess, because
understood.
The contract is what I would go to first,
okay.
And then the facts.
All right. Okay. The second finding that the Court of Appeals had that I thought was significant was the finding that the trademark infringement constituted a, quote, enumerated offense, close quote. We believe that's contrary to the Fireman's Fund decision, as I want to talk about in one of the key points I want to bring up here. The third point that the Court of Appeals found related to the so-called white paper or white sleeve, which I will break down for you in a little more detail in a moment. What that was essentially is the practice when customers would ask for a sample of the product, they would be sent the product in a white sleeve. The Court of Appeals, for copyright infringement purposes, indicated that this was sufficient to constitute advertising, the sending of the item in the white sleeve. That was necessary to support coverage for copyright infringement with respect to this matter. The final point was the Court of Appeals inferred a causal nexus between so-called advertising and the damages or loss here without any indication as to exactly where that came from. The Court of Appeals took the phrase from Fireman's Fund, which was a duty to defend case where the issue is very broadly construed, and said, well, there must have been some contribution by the advertising to what happened here, and therefore that's enough of a causal nexus. There are some other points in the Court of Appeals' opinion that I would want to point out as we go forth here. I think the final fact I want to talk about before moving to the issues relates to just what advertising issues are in play or what's claimed as advertising. The first item is what I have referred to as, occasionally I refer to it as the magic sentence, and that's found at Appellant's Appendix, page 31, page 4 of the trial court decision in Oregon. It's stated there that Unique sells computer software to resellers. Its primary business is to purchase the software at liquidation or closeout sales at significantly discounted prices. This is what I've referred to as the sentence that's been utilized and referred to as creating advertising claims here. It advertised the SystemWorks software through trade magazines, telephone marketing, direct mailing, and supplying samples to interested buyers. Now, that sentence is there, but there's nothing in the decision that indicates that's linked to any of the wrongdoing here or exactly how it's linked into this entire matter. It's merely a sentence that stands there in what's essentially an introductory portion of the opinion. This is the one portion where there's advertising an issue. This is with respect to the trademark infringement issue only. The second issue relates to the white sleeve or the white paper, and I think that is also, well, that is actually also discussed at Appellant's Appendix, page 31, page 4 of the federal court decision, and that refers to, I think, the amicus brief from the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance best defined that. The white sleeve refers to distribution of the product on request. And I think that's I'm going to use the short term white sleeve or white paper in referring to that, but that's essentially where one of your customers, I think this is, my understanding is this is a fairly small industry, as you might imagine. Somebody calls up and says, well, I'm interested in this, and they're sent to a product in a white sleeve. If that's what the customer wants, then there's a larger order made.
Where do you find white sleeve, if you know easily, in the Court of Appeals opinion?
31.
In the Court of Appeals opinion.
They talk about the distribution of the product with white sleeve.
The reason, are you catching him?
No.
The reason I'm not. Mr. Simpson, you have to.
Stay by the microphone.
Yes, exactly. You know the rules.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
The reason I'm asking is I noted in your brief white sleeve being mentioned many times. Let me just pick a number that might be reflective. 8 to 10 times that the words white sleeve. And yet, I didn't go back and recheck the Court of Appeals opinion, but I hardly recalled it being referenced. I'm sure it is. But it just didn't seem to have the moment in the Court of Appeals opinion that you were trying to make of it. It seemed to me in your brief. And so I wasn't totally sure what you were trying to make of the words white sleeve in your brief.
Well, I don't know that there was any enormous moment. It seemed to me that was a quick shorthand for saying if a customer wanted a product, they would say, I'm interested in this. Mr. Bagadia would then send them in a plain white sleeve a copy of the unauthorized software. They would look at it, and if that was acceptable to them, then an order would be placed. And it just struck me as easier to say white sleeve than to say all that. Maybe I should have made that
clear. I didn't get it. I thought you were saying something was wrong about, that was important that it was in a white sleeve. You were just using that as shorthand to saying sending a sample.
Huh? I'm not trying to say any great evil doing by that. I'm just trying to shorten things up. I do think there's a problem with saying that sale and distribution of a product, that has nothing to do with advertising. And to say that that's defined, that falls within either your broad or narrow definition of advertising, we are contesting that issue rather vigorously. I don't under either standard. My position is, if that's advertising, then give me an example of how it's humanly possible to sell a product without advertising, although I'm skipping ahead here.
You're going to have to slow down a bit for me.
All right, sorry.
That's okay. You've got a lot to cover here. And remind me then, as we were talking about the white sleeve now, what point are you making in your argument? You said there are two things. You know, you finished looking at the Court of Appeals, and you went through four things in the Court of Appeals opinion. And now, where are you in your argument?
Well, I'm just trying to – the last fact I wanted to put forth was just sort of a – of what advertising terms or theories are being cast about here as constituting advertising. The final one of those is there are references mostly in semantics brief to various discovery facts that were discussed in the litigation but not part of a court finding out in Oregon. And that, again, that comes to the issue of whether when you have a duty to indemnify, you can simply pick facts out as you go or whether you have to rely on the facts as the basis for the decision. That's a quick overview of what I think are the pertinent facts and where we stand procedurally. Issue-wise, I want to focus, first of all, on whether there is an enumerated offense with respect to trademark infringement. Secondly, is there advertising, or is this just the sale and distribution of a product which would not be covered? That's a different issue with copyright and trademark, as the Court of Appeals noted. Third issue is, did the advertising injury cause damages? Lastly, there are some procedural issues about the scope of the duty to indemnify and defend, and we also had an issue about a payment by CNA. We would simply stand on our brief with respect to both those arguments unless the court wants to hear something more from me on those. I want to focus on those first three issues, which I think are the most significant here.
I'm going, if I may respond, and that is, it seems now you're going into the framework that really your opposing counsel set forth in its argument, the three elements, if you will. The first one, what's enumerated. The second is, what constitutes, does the conduct constitute advertising? And the third is causal connection. Is that the way you're structuring your argument?
I think that's, we specifically did that in our reply brief. I think we were a little more scattered, perhaps, than I should have been in the initial brief with respect to that. But those are the three issues. That's sort of the holy grail as laid out by Fireman's Fund in 2002 with respect to these issues.
And that's what the Court of Appeals followed also.
They went down that chronology. Yeah. How they concluded their determinations in that chronology is why we're here. The first issue relates to enumerated offense. At paragraph 27 of the Fireman's Fund decision, this court indicated that if you do not have an enumerated offense, it's not covered. And so that becomes obviously important here. Copyright in our policy contains a reference to advertising injury, including infringement of trademark, copyright, title, or slogan. We've never contested that copyright is an enumerated offense. The issue is going to be whether the white sleeve, as I've referred to it, in level two, as to whether or not that's advertising, and in level three, whether there's a causal connection between the so-called white sleeve and the damages.
Now, with regard to the enumerated offense, you're never certainly it's enumerated for purposes of copyright, right in there, right in your contract, right? Enumerated offense, copyright.
Yeah, I'm not contesting that.
That's right. So your enumerated offense argument only goes to trademark. Is
correct.
That correct? Okay. And then the argument deals with whether or not it fits under, in the contract, it fits under C, misappropriation of advertising deals or styles, or D, infringement of title. Right? Is that where we are then?
That's the arguments that I believe Semantic posed, and our position is that it does not fit under those. Trademark infringement
right.
does not fit under there.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
If you look at paragraph footnotes 3 and 4 and the language attached to those in the Fireman's Fund decision initially, this court indicated that it is a standard effort by CGL, referring to comprehensive general liability insureds, to try to broaden coverage by claiming trademark infringement covered under these two rubrics, misappropriation and style of doing business, or infringement of trademark, copyright, title, or slogan. I gave the marshal, and I believe the members of the court have, or perhaps not, okay, I would ask that the court be what I have done, and I gave Mr. Skilton a copy as well, is a copy of paragraph 25 and footnote 23 of the Fireman's Fund decision, because I think it's very important to look at exactly what was there. I'd ask permission of the court that those be circulated.
Do you have any objections, Mr. Skilton? Marshall?
Counselor, if I were to, for the sake of argument, buy your argument that trademark
infringement is not an enumerated offense, but I disagree with your argument that the sending of samples is not advertising and conclude it is advertising. Are the damages any different?
Let me see. Part one of that was trademark infringement is an enumerated offense.
Is not.
Is not enumerated.
Is not.
Offense.
That falls out. But you conceded that copyright infringement is in fact enumerated. And if I don't buy your argument about the advertising, but do conclude that sending samples under the facts of this case is advertising, are the damages any different?
Yeah, trademark infringement falls out, copyright infringement's still there.
Okay, so what's the difference in damages? That's my question to you.
Whatever the trademark infringement damages were.
Now we have to...
306, trademark is 360,000.
Okay, thank you.
Paragraph 25 of the Fireman's Fund decision refers to the policy, the standard policy language, and the actual section C and D there refer to the language in the Fireman's Fund policy, which included infringement of trademark at D. The footnote then indicates insurance policies provided earlier did not include coverage for trademark infringement. D above originally covered only infringement of copyright, title, or slogan. Trademark infringement was added by a broadened form endorsement, executed 1998 and 1999 policies. And neither party disputed that trademark infringement would apply in the present case. That's important because to me it seems that the unanimous court 6 years ago gave indication that under the type policy that we have, there was no enumerated offense for trademark infringement. I wanted to bring that out. I wanted the court to see that footnote directly. It's referred to in our briefs, but I thought it's significant enough that we take a direct look at it.
You're saying there's a negative implication that before the addition of trademark wasn't there.
Right. Why would you add it otherwise?
To make it clearer.
Well, then why would you have this comment that it was broadened at that point as opposed to made clearer?
The question is, where did that come from? Was that the argument of the parties? Is the broadened form a general form on CGL or this specific company's?
Broad form endorsement is a term of art. Didn't we used to use that with some regularity in CGLs, I think? It's like a term of art. This is a broad form endorsement.
And I'm not sure I'm tracking you.
I'm not sure that this means that it was broadened. I'm not sure that it's a verb. I always thought of a broad form endorsement as something, not that it's broadened. Maybe I'm wrong, but
well,
do we use broad formed endorsements anymore? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm not sure what it is, and I'm not sure how that would be significant. The comment is trademark infringement was added by a broadened form endorsement to the policies in 1998 and 1999.
Here it is, right here. I'm reading from the law review article that's cited in Fireman's Fund, and it's by Graf. And on page 941, he says, it was common, though, for the broad form endorsement to also contain. See, we used to use that term, broad form endorsement. And that one of the more common endorsements purchased by insureds to the pre-1986 CGL policy was the broad form comprehensive general liability endorsement. That's what I was thinking of. So this law review article uses it in this terms. It's the broad form endorsement rather than the endorsement was broadening some kind of coverage. Make any sense to you? Doesn't make any sense to
you. I'm not really tracking what you're saying. I'm not sure how that moves our argument one way or the other. I guess I'm just lost on that.
Let's just deal with, for the moment, enumerated offenses. Okay. It's going to either come under infringement of trademark, is either going to come under infringement of copyright, title, or slogan, right? Or it's going to come under misappropriation of advertising ideas or style of doing business. Is that what the argument is?
Those are the
about?
Arguments that are being advanced by
okay.
Symantec.
And your argument is it's not under infringement, trademark isn't on infringement because it's not listed.
Correct.
And the words copyright, title, or slogan are not broad enough.
Correct. And I will acknowledge that there is a split of authority on this.
Okay.
There are cases, I think the sixth, they were cited particularly in the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance brief at page 6. I know that Symantec cited cases to the contrary in their brief as well. My position on this is that you come back to the Fireman's Fund decision. Why do you add trademark? The argument being, well, to make it clear, they're paying an additional premium, presumably for trademark insurance. If it was already there, why are you paying more money for nothing? Would be my argument with that. Why would a reasonable person go through all this analysis of misappropriation, style of doing business, infringement of title? If you've got a trademark claim and you have trademark insurance, it's covered. If you don't, it isn't. And that certainly seems to me what footnote 23 that I passed out here was aimed at back in 2002. I do want to comment on Section C with respect to misappropriation of advertising ideas or style of doing business. Strikes me as unusual that something as common as a trademark infringement claim, we have to go through analysis of two separate subparts to try to find somewhere that it actually would be trademark infringement. But in the Atlantic Mutual versus Badger Supply case, style of doing business was referred to as an inherently distinct manner of doing business. Advertising idea was referred to as an idea to call public attention to something. There's nothing in this record that suggests we have anything that would fit under Section C in any way, shape, or form. I think Symantec's argument, although they've raised that argument, they principally have argued that somehow title and trademark are one and the same. And to me, the Fireman's Fund decision seems at odds with that as the law in the state of Wisconsin. I'd like to move forward.
Let me just ask again this article. It talks about the majority of courts that have addressed this issue, that is, whether or not in the standard form CGL it is an enumerated offense, have construed the term misappropriation broadly and have accordingly held that a claim for trademark or trade dress infringement falls under the offense of misappropriation of advertising ideas or style of doing business. So according to this law reviewer article anyway, the majority of courts have put trademark under the misappropriation of advertising ideas or styles under C rather than under D as the Wisconsin court did most recently in that Western Wisconsin water case.
Well, that my understanding was the Atlantic Mutual and Badger Supply case talked about this issue and did not go down that particular path with respect to these types of claims. That's the precedent here. That's a Court of Appeals opinion. I will tell you that there is a split of authority with respect to that around the country. There are cases that cut both ways with respect to it. What I'm looking at is the Wisconsin Authority and Fireman's Fund and Atlantic Mutual with respect to points C and D. And I think I still come back to this common sense proposition. Why do we write this separate coverage for trademark infringement? These are commercial, sophisticated buyers. Why do they go out and buy this trademark infringement coverage if they've got the coverage already? I don't know why they would do that. If this is something that's read into these policies or that exists there, why is it that the companies are selling this additional coverage with respect to it? And I think that is a good. It's a common sense touchstone with respect to the whole thing. The second point I'd like to move up to is advertising.
Okay, let me just ask you, if you should succeed on that, it's not an enumerated offense. Does that end the case?
Correct, on as far as trademark infringement. Paragraph 27 of the Fireman's Fund decision says if it's not enumerated, it's not covered.
Okay.
Advertising would be the second issue. And there, the question, it really breaks down into three points. Does a broad or narrow definition apply? Does the white sleeve fit even within the broad definition? Clearly it does not within the narrow, as the Court of Appeals acknowledged. And lastly, does the sentence that I referred to earlier from the Oregon opinion show any, does that, and I think this flows more into the causal nexus issue, quite frankly, with respect to that. Is there any showing that this so-called advertising caused any harm or caused any of the damages here? It's important to note that paragraph 7 of the Court of Appeals opinion, and a point that I don't believe Semantic disputes, looking at paragraph 29 or page 29 of their brief, the issue of the distribution through the white sleeve is the issue as to whether or not there's been advertising activity with respect to the copyright claim. Now, the trademark, the magic sentence, comes into play with respect to that. And forgive me for using that term, but I'm going to use it because it's a shorthand for what appears at page 4 of the Oregon District Court, in the interest of time. The real question here is, how did pirated software become advertising? The broad and narrow definitions are found at paragraph 43 of the Fireman's Fund case. The broad definition, any oral, written, or graphic statement made by the seller in any manner in connection with the solicitation of the business. Narrow, widespread announcements or distribution of promotional materials. I think the insurance policy, the contract that started us in all this, should be looked at as well. That indicates advertising injury caused by an offense committed in the course of advertising your goods, services, or products.
Is it true that if I read the page 3 of the Oregon decision where it says Unix sold system work software to resellers and advertised through trade magazines and telephone marketing, email, and direct mail, that they were using the name System Works in their advertisements in these telephone marketing and email marketing?
That's a good question. I don't know. I can tell you what the sentence says. That's what the decision was out there.
Wasn't there a stipulation of facts that you stipulated to that? Am I in the wrong case?
There is some reference to some stipulated facts in the record. Our position is, and this gets us to the issue of what relates to an indemnity claim, is that the facts that the court relies on for its decision are what determines whether the insurance company has to pay. We're not talking about what might or could have occurred, which would be with respect to the duty to defend.
So you think that statement that I read to you could be read in more than one sense? Is that your response?
Yeah.
Okay. That's all.
My time is up. If we could have 30 seconds to summarize.
You have 30 seconds to summarize, then you get 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay. Counsel. Thank you. I don't believe that there's any showing that this white sleeve, with the white sleeve, my only comment is this. If that's advertising as opposed to sale or distribution of a product, then I'd like to know how it's humanly possible to do anything that is not advertising. It's just not advertising. Look at page 28 of our brief, footnote 6, and we have a detailed description of all the cases on that point. With respect to causal nexus, my only comment with respect to that is the court and Fireman's Fund looked at whether or not the damages were caused by advertising. Now, how you do that, there's various ways you can approach that, but there's nothing in the record here that shows any of the damages here were caused by advertising, regardless of how you look at the causation issue. The Court of Appeals acknowledged that at paragraph 13 of its opinion when it stated, we acknowledge that the damages here were caused by the sale of unauthorized software. First sentence, paragraph 13. I have other comments, but I've used my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Mr. Skelton, representing Samantha.
May it please the Court, John Skelton. I'm here with Christopher Stoll from the Heller Ehrman office in San Francisco, and we are representing Semantic and Quarterdeck on this appeal. I think the Court has put its finger on a number of questions that really are primal and pivotal in the analysis. First, it is a contract case, and the way one approaches, or the Court approaches the reading of it, is from the perspective of a person of, I'm going to say, common understanding, relatively sophisticated as a businessman, but reading these terms for what they would mean to him in terms of the business that he does. And so questions of whether a trademark was in or out as an express term it seems to me, are related to whether a court can fairly construe what was covered and what is an enumerated offense to include trademark. It's an interesting history with respect to the issue of whether trademark was expressly in these kinds of policies. Although it's not in our brief, it is in the appendix, wherein we point out that in an earlier version of these kinds of general liability products, trademark infringement was expressly excluded in the case I'm referring to, as appears at RAPPO293. The court finds that's not dispositive, but it also suggests to me that if the carrier wanted to exclude it, it could have done so easily, and in fact, still can do so. But that begs the question of whether the language as it exists covers an enumerated offense, including trademark infringement. And there I can't do, in terms of my argument, any better than the Charter Oak case and the rationale the court applied. The Seventh Circuit did. It was, of course, attempting to predict and apply Wisconsin law. But nevertheless, it was a case that directly addressed the issue, and for that question of whether or not an infringement of title includes a trademark infringement, I rely on that case and the rationale. And Justice Bradley pointed to other elements under the third part of the test of the enumeration, misappropriation of advertising ideas, and the cases that she cited, or the authority is, again, the authority that we would cite in response to an issue not decided by the Court of Appeals, but this Court can support, as a matter of law, as this is a contract case, construction of that provision as well, to be an enumerated offense sufficient to trigger the question of advertising injury.
Mr. Skilton, if I can ask you about that. When I think of the term enumerated, it suggests that it's something that's named. And I understand the Charles decision in construing title to include trademark. But if I understand Mr. Simpson's position, his argument is that if it's enumerated, it's a named offense, and here it's nowhere named. How do you respond to that?
Well, first I would respond that enumerated, it seems to me, can be plainly meaning listed or included within a list or described in the list. I would say that the Charter Oak opinion meets that. The other thing about Charter Oak that I found interesting is that it took the word title, but it took it in the full context of the phrase and indicated that the reader would be persuaded by that full phrase, copyright, title, etc., that what was being covered, in fact, were violations or enumerations or whatever that were within his advertising portfolio and within that plan. It's broader than just even the word title, but it's this kind of copyright, intangible attribution of source and reliability, et cetera, all of those things that are incorporated in, yes, trademark, but also within the broader three categories that are included within that which was enumerated. So my answer is, again, a Charter Oak answer, but I think it does answer the court's question. I think one of the things that is overlooked in the efforts here to read literally the Fireman's Fund decision on both advertising as well as injury caused by advertising is, I thought, the most important point in terms of this case today, and that is the court's determination that in defining advertising, and I'll read the court's language here. I'm reading from page 679 of the opinion. In many cases.
What paragraph?
Yes, Your Honor, this would be paragraph 43 at the end of it. After the court lays out this, the alternative of the broad definition and the narrow definition, where I read as instructive in this case is the last sentence of that paragraph. In many cases, the specific context, including the product and the business, will dictate a particular interpretation. And very interestingly, the court cites to Charter Oak, wherein, call it broad or narrow, I always get confused because they seem to be counterindicated to me in terms of normal reading. But that said, Charter Oak felt it was a relatively limited audience, but that audience was sufficient in that case under those facts to constitute advertising, and I'd say advertising injury if the enumerated offense occurs in the course of that advertising program. Which leads me to suggest to the court this statement, and this analysis leads me to suggest to the court that the concept of picking out a trademark violation and limiting it to this white sleeve argument and saying that's all there was to advertising here with respect to the copyright issue is really counterindicated, contradicted by the kind of analysis I think is correct here. And again, we're talking about what would the person who buys this carrier think he was getting if he undertook an advertising program. What was the advertising program here? And how did these enumerated offenses as they occurred constitute the kind of advertising injury that was expressly contracted for here so as to cause damages here? The whole concept started, and this is found in the literal words of the Oregon court, because I certainly agree that you need that underlying finding of liability, certainly on enumerated offenses. That includes and permits the court to find that advertising injury here was certainly part of the harm and a substantial part, or however the court in Fireman's Fund described the test. It was materially important or substantially important or something like that. And that court decision is adequate to say that it finds advertising, in the words that have been already put on this record, and it finds then the trademark injuries and the copyright injuries expressly, and also it finds a Lanham Act false designation of origin. That's also in the district court decision, its findings and its opinions. And most importantly, then, it enjoins, as its final element of relief, advertising activity. Just look right at the injunction and the terms of it. It takes it full circle. It isn't finding damages that are expressly related to advertising injury. I say it's an inference the court has to make from the record in that case and the findings as made by the district court that, in fact, that's what occurred. But those findings permit this court and the Court of Appeals to find that, in fact, there was a record basis for a determination that advertising injury occurred, that it started, that's the express finding, that injury occurred in the process by reason of enumerated offenses, and furthermore, the court found it was sufficiently important as a source of harm to have enjoined that kind of advertising.
What did they find was the advertising?
Well, what they found was what has been recited. If I can, I'll go back to the literal quotation. But I do think I can supplement that by undisputed facts on the record that are in the Umberger Declaration that are the ads themselves, and they are RAP067, the two I'm waving in front of the court, and RAP0059. But what the court found is what is quoted in both briefs. I'm sorry, I'm stumbling here a little bit. UNIC advertised the SystemWorks software through trade magazines, telephone marketing, direct mailing, and supplying samples to interested buyers. All of those things, including the supplying of samples. And if you look at what the program was in the beginning, it depended upon, for its effect and consequence, this is a very interesting finding, by the way, of the Court of Appeals, when it looked at the issue of copyright harm or whether or not advertising injury occurred. It, in its broader statement, relates it back to the fact that it was the sine qua non of the advertising program. What do I mean? They had to advertise semantics, trademarks, and its titles, And it had to, and that was disseminated to a wide audience. It was a trade audience in trade magazines and emails, but there is no definition of advertising that doesn't include narrow or broad, I believe, the advertising program that was initiated by Mr. Bogosian. And as if you follow that through on a chain basis, just make it a chain link fence on a causal basis, you'll find that the next step was for the customer to read the ad and call the eunuch company, upon which they then supplied, with probably that advertisement in the hand of the recipient who made the request, the white sleeves.
Now, what in the ads were trademarked?
All right, the ads say Semantic, a trademark name. Let me read, and again, for the record, for the court's convenience when it gets to Chambers, RAP0067 is the ad I'm reading from now, and it's an offer. We buy and sell software from Eunuch, and it lists Semantic, System Works, Antivirus 2002, et cetera.
So those names are trademarks. Is that correct? Is there any logo, like the Norton Antivirus, if I recall, has some kind of a logo? Is there any logo?
Your Honor, there was the logo for sure. I'm not sure whether any of the ads say it as a logo, but remember, I was getting to the point where I said the sleeves are sent. And what is the purpose of that advertising program as it relates to the sleeves? The customer, of course, is asked then to take the CD-ROM out, an antivirus specific to CD-type product, and play it. Logos are displayed on screen. The copyrighted material is disclosed. And, of course, the customer is led to believe that the product has value and its source is a good source by the use of the logos and the copyright, all attributable to Semantic and its product. So as part of this advertising scheme in a chain, it all depends in terms of the sale of this particular product in the sleeve on the customer having read that ad in the first instance, which displays the trademarks and the names, et cetera, playing the and if it likes the results and if it thinks it's worth buying, it then makes a volume order. And so it's very artificial to say, well, let's see whether advertising occurred when somebody sends in response to a specific request a CD-ROM in a white jacket. I say that really doesn't state the full context of the facts in the business, which I believe the court was expressly telling its lower courts to do in the sentence that I read. I think it is the full context of the business, of the program, and how it related to this particular sale. So I would suggest to the court that the chain link is a full causation, that the advertising program is clear under either a definition, and that advertising injury occurred. And I think I've gotten through all the elements, save, I guess, one. And that is, how does one show nexus? And how does nexus relate to damages? Again, I will borrow from the analytical framework of the court. I don't have the paragraphs, Justice Abrahamson, but I can find them quickly, as it relates to the question of causal nexus. It's the third part toward the end of the discussion relating to these elements. But let me give you my understanding of how it should function in terms of how an insured would look at this policy and what he think should be covered by advertising injury as the result of enumerated offenses that occurred in the course of the advertising. And that is to say that if the program is essential to the sale, and furthermore, I think the court doesn't need to speculate, it's what caused the sales. That is the advertising program. It's what invited the sales. And integral to the success of those sales was the violation of enumerated offenses, as I've indicated. And damages occurred. Then you have that nexus linked here to the advertising program and the advertising conduct, which was what this insured thought he had purchased. Now, there's one other thing. We've had, I think, a
Counsel, may I ask just a quick question? I'm trying to reconcile and sort out the difference between copyright and trademark and the ad at 67 and paragraph 7 of the Court of Appeals decision. And at paragraph 7, the court indicates that the magazine advertisements use Symantec's trademarks. The advertisements did not violate Symantec's copyrights because it's the programs themselves, not their names, that are copyrighted. You agree with that?
You know, Your Honor, I didn't quickly locate it. Let me let me rephrase it to the way I do understand it, and that is, in the first instance, when you're marketing under the trade name or the trademark or the title, that in and of itself does not constitute a copyright violation. I would submit, however, it is invited by this program, and it occurs at the time of the playing of the text, which is copyrighted, which is a violation of copyright, which text and the playing of it in the context of the disc itself, which is part of the program, is one of the enumerated acts.
So distributing the product is the advertisement?
Yeah.
Because that's when the advertisement copyright comes up?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Sorry.
My understanding would be of this program, this advertising program, that unless the disc was played and the copyright was violated, no one would ever buy it. So inherent in the whole program, as it was thought out, by the way, this person thought he was not doing it illegally. That's in the Oregon decision. So the use of the word pirating, I think, begs the question of pirating what and why do we talk about it. It's a contract question, is the way I would respond. In any event, it goes nowhere. But my point on the how the copyright violation occurred is, first of all, it did occur, and I would, rather than using my articulation, I'm trying to articulate it in the context of advertising injury and in the course of advertising the standards here. But, of course, the district court made special and specific findings on copyright violation. But as it relates to the advertising program, which is how I understand it, I believe that the advertising program, as its fundamental tenet, and this is what the Court of Appeals said, it depended on the playing of copyrighted material and therefore the violation of copyright. That was the sine qua non, in many respects, of the entire point of advertising. Here we've got it. This is a Symantec product. Ask for it, we'll send you a copy, confirm it, play it, violate it. If you like it, we'll send you the rest. That was the advertising program, simply stated. I think the contract was intended to cover this kind of an advertising program, and we are not stretching the language. Justice Prosser.
Could you explain to me in nice layman's terms, on this page 67, you have the reference to Symantec System Works Antivirus. Right above that, there's Lotus Smart Suite Millennium, Coral WP Suite 2002, I think it is.
We don't own those copyrights.
Yeah, well, okay. But was there a copyright violation with respect to the other ones? Or how?
I would assume, Your Honor, if any one of these entities owning these trademarks or these titles found as a result of this program that it permitted the unauthorized infringement of their trademark or copyright, and it was insured under similar policies, and they sue and they obtain a recovery, they would likely be asking the carrier, if any carrier there were, that covered that unlawful sale and use of the copyright in an advertising program to indemnify the person they sued in order for them to get paid. I don't know whether those are layman's terms, but that was my... These are not Symantec copyrights in that, trademarks in that ad, other than Symantec System Works Antivirus 2002. Those are owned by Symantec, and that's what begins the fall of the dominoes through the sale. How does the customer know it's got a Symantec one? It plays the tape, Igor. It has it in the white, it's sent in a white envelope. It's pulled out. It's played. They see the brands. They see the copyrights. They see the Norton names and et cetera and the various programs, all of which are attributing source and quality. And the rest of what a trademark or a copyright connotes.
Well, what is the gist of this? That no one except semantic can sell these things? You can't, there's no middle person? Middle man?
If authorized, if licensed. I mean, this is intellectual property. So you're talking about the right of the owner of that mark or that copyright to control, authorize, sale and distribution. And so that integral to the system that we have is that right to protect. And that means there can't be pirates or persons without authority copying or selling outside of the chain that's authorized.
Hypothetically, if Justice Butler bought semantic products and then he decided he didn't need them anymore and he sold them to me, I may not sell them to Justice Bradley?
Well, you're at probing depths of trademark damage law and authority to sell and implied license and fair use and other things that I'm not qualified to answer and wouldn't fairly answer to the court. But I can say that there are areas of resale and distribution within a commercial chain by commercial sellers that are reachable, and it isn't necessarily a matter of whether you intended to violate. The remedy might be simply you get enjoined from doing it again. But again, I'm not here to attempt to answer hypotheticals that I'm not fully qualified to answer. But in a short term is these are protected marks. The owner of those marks has a right to be compensated for them and to license them. And they are not marks that can be used outside of that system established by the law for persons to take and use as they will and sell at a discount and make a lot of money and profits on it. And when they do it, that's what happens in the Oregon court, and that's what the district court there dealt with at some considerable length, both in the underlying decision and its specific findings of fact.
Mr. Skilton, can you deal for a couple minutes with the question of offset in regard to the Continental insurance payment?
Yes, Your Honor. All right. That's a fair question. I know it would trouble the court. I will first state to this court, as the trial court was advised, both in letters and I think on the record, that this is not any attempt to obtain more than the full amount of the judgment, no double recovery. The issue that I think it was briefed was that the issue of reservation of rights in the first payment, what were the conditions, would they withdraw it, how it relates to the payment that we're seeking here, isn't resolved. And until it's resolved, it isn't a matter of simply deducting an amount that's paid. And so accordingly, for the court's benefit, we are not here to say we get the stack, for example, using a term. It's a matter of rightness on the record and a matter of then conclusion as between the two carriers, perhaps by agreement or settlement and or in the trial court as to whether, in fact, any additional credits might be permitted.
Is this question really ripe for us to be deciding or properly before us? We don't have the other carrier appearing before us.
Your Honor, I'd answer it's not ripe for you. I would agree with the
we don't have
the question.
We don't have the policy.
Take it off the list.
We don't have the policy, I don't think, in the right. Nor do we know who's primary right. Or excess or anything.
That really is the point. The record doesn't permit any kind of judicial resolution of that, only to say that it would be unfair to say that you deduct it because it's our position we get the stack. That's not our position. And we've stated to the court that we do not intend to double recover here. I think I'm done with my argument in a somewhat different order than I had intended.
Mr. Skilton, I do have a question for you.
Yes.
With respect to the activity that's complained of, the purchases and the so-called advertising, that activity occurred when?
At the beginning of the process, and by definition then before the delivery upon request of the white sleeves.
No, I understand that, but as I'm looking at the dates in the materials, the dates seem to have, some of them involve the versions from 2001 System Works, some involve 2002, some involve 2003, there's a reference to a date of purchase of some of the materials in August of 2001, August 27th of 2001. In the court's opinion, there are other activities that take place after that date. And I'm trying to get my handle around the activity that's complained of with respect to the Charter Oak decision, which was in February of 2002.
On the issue of how that's applied in this court, I think that is an issue that's separate. On the issue of whether anyone has contended it's not a covered act for purpose of this advertising or any piece of it is not a covered act for purposes of this policy, I don't think anyone has so contended. The record in the Oregon court does it show dates for shipments and the like. I haven't prepared myself to give the court more of an answer than that, but I do think, I would say for purposes of this argument, I don't think there's any question that any of the ads were before the policy was effective. I haven't heard that said, so that this advertising program is covered if the other elements of advertising are met.
Skelton, on this page 67 again, these other items, Lotus Smart Suite Millennium, you're supposed to call. If a sample of a Lotus Smart Suite Millennium is sent out, is that advertising too?
Well, I believe it's part of the advertising program, so my answer would be yes. I do not have the evidence of what the caller asked, so let's start with that. But presumably, if I had an ad like this, I would read it, and I'd decide whether I want to call this guy, and it's not unlikely that I'd specify the brand. It may be that he'd say, send me whatever you got, but let's assume that the ad works as one would expect. Why else would they have use the semantic name? I make the response as a consumer based on the fact that I'm one of hundreds of people, trade magazines it's published in, I believe, that's my understanding. I understand telephone calls, emails. If there's a broadcast of the availability of this product and the consumer, whoever he is, responds by telephone and a request. Presumably, this happened with the consumer saying, send me the semantic system works antivirus 2002. That's what precipitates the white sleeve coming through, if it's been that specific a request. And even if it isn't, when that white sleeve comes through, the consumer will right away know by pulling it and playing it, that it is trademarked to Symantec with the various trade names, and that it contains copyrighted material that is the origin of which is Symantec. So my view is yes to long-winded answer, yes, it's advertising, and in the full context of the program as designed, the offenses were designed to be integral to that program in order for it to succeed, which is why I think it was covered.
If I were going to write this opinion, or rather you were going to write this opinion, I want you to give...
Skewed old.
Better me than you? No. For your purposes at the moment, better you than me.
Watch out.
Watch out is right. I want you to dictate to me, and I'll ask you, Mrs. Simpson, the same, what we are fond of calling our bookends here. That is one of the early paragraphs in the decision that says, we affirm or reverse the Court of Appeals, and we hold that one.
This case arises out of an advertising injury.
No, first start with an enumerated offense. Isn't that your first thing? Don't you need an enumerated offense?
The court finds that amongst the enumerated offenses is the infringement of a copyright title or slogan.
And that's under the definition of advertising injury that's covered?
Yes, Your Honor. That's an enumerated offense, and for the reasons set forth in the chart.
And are you under copyright title, slogan, or advertising ideas? Which one are you?
Well, and then I think the court has an alternative basis. Another offense is misappropriation of advertising ideas. That was the issue reserved, not taken by the path right. not taken. So the court has the option, and I
but you're
would
under
argue
infringement
under
of title. Is that what you're going under?
Misappropriation of advertising ideas, I think, has been the gravamen or the basis for those decisions.
Although I think the Court of Appeals here did infringement of title, didn't
right.
it?
Right. That's what my understanding is. So
that was the basis.
That's your enumeration, one or the other. All right. Because?
Because these were offenses committed in the course of an advertising program, which program, defining advertising as we've discussed, which program caused advertising injury as the result of these offenses, which injury had, I guess I've said enough. That's how I'd start it, but it would be edited by two or three law clerks before it hit print.
Luckily.
And several justices.
That's right. May I just ask one follow-up question? Under your logic, then, it doesn't matter that the Symantec name is in this ad at page 67. It's the distribution in the white envelope that gets played on the computer and the name comes up on the screen that is the injury. The copyright infringement.
No, that is not what I was trying to say. If I said it, I said it wrong. It's the chain of advertising depends upon the use of the Symantec name in the first instance, which is distributed widely to an audience by email, by trade publication, etc. It is integral to the effectuation which occurs when someone calls and asks for it, at which point additional offenses occur, copyright, for example, but in the course of that same and anticipated by that same advertising program.
But the program name is not copyrighted. The program itself is, yes?
As I understand the copyright law, you protect the content, the words used in the program or its computer aspects by the copyright. The material itself is what is copyrighted, that which is played. And that bears the protection of the C, which is, if you will, a notice to the person playing it that he is, in fact, playing copyrighted material. And, of course, that's a source and an accuracy indicator. So, Justice Ziegler, my point is this. This was part of the advertising scheme or plan. It was integral to it. And as the Court of Appeals said, it was probably the most valuable part of it. And when it talks about this issue, the Court of Appeals expressly notes the importance of the playing of this to the success of the advertising program. So I would argue its rationale is broader than just saying the question. It is not a question of whether somebody responds to or asks for a copy of the disc. That's all we're talking about. And that's what Acuity is arguing. All we look at here, as far as they're concerned, is the fact that somebody asked for a disc and it was sent back, and if that happens, everything is advertising. And I think that really misstates what happened here, what the role of it was in the course of this program. So I would argue that Acuity's argument is wrong as a matter of law and doesn't take into account the court's rationale and decision in the Fireman's Fund case.
If I may, just for clarification,
Justice
so
Bradley.
Following up on Justice Ziegler's question, the use of the name Symantec is not part of the copyright infringement. Copyright infringement deals with material.
That's
here.
My understanding. And although, interesting, Justice Bradley, the court found both could occur simultaneously. If you looked at the Oregon decision, I'm not sure that was quite as precious as that because the judge expressly found that in the context of copyright and trademark, both injuries, both wrongs could occur simultaneously.
Yes, but that's not, but they're different. What my point is, they are different wrongs. And so let's get the wrongs right, okay? So, from my point of view, anyway. And that is, the name Symantec, however, is a registered trademark. The complaint indicates that Symantec was registered on April 21st, 1992, with a registration number set forth in the complaint.
as is Norton System Works. That, those words, Norton System Works, are a registered trademark. So use of those names go to the trademark violation and not the copyright
right.
violation.
But right. Defining trademark as a Charter Oak did to include titles and other matters that are synonymous is, I believe, the way they really controlled that question with trademark. So that with that qualification, I would agree. Thank you, Your Honors.
Questions. Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Mr. Simpson?
My dictated opinion first.
Pardon me? Yes, you may.
This isn't really fair because I've had 3 minutes to think about it.
Start with reverse.
We'll go reversed and remanded the license plates I want to get. The opening sentence would come from paragraph 13 of the Court of Appeals opinion. The ultimate harm to Symantec was unique sale of unauthorized software. This court holds that the unauthorized sale of a product is not advertising injury under a CGL policy. The court first holds that trademark infringement is not included within the CGL policy language as is set forth in the Acuity policy. Separate trademark infringement coverage can be purchased if desired. It was not purchased in this case. The court further holds that the use of the white sleeve to distribute these products is not advertising. In fact, if this were advertising, then everything would be advertising, and the policy itself would cover distribution and sale of products, which it does not. See footnote 6, page 28 of our brief for the case law on that. Now, the court further holds that regardless of either of the above positions, there is no indication that any damages here were caused by advertising. The damages here were caused by the sale and distribution of unauthorized software. Court of Appeals at paragraph 13, first sentence of the Court of Appeals opinion, the entire decision from the Oregon court. And that would be the way I would start an opinion.
Counselor, if I can line up your argument with Mr. Skilton's argument, it seems to me that you define advertising as a piece of what he calls the program, the advertising program. And he wants us to take the whole baby and put it together and say, because it's a whole, it's not something you can separate, because they didn't occur in a vacuum, they occurred as a continuum, this is advertising. When you hand the sleeve and then they play copyrighted material that they have no right to be distributing, okay? So I want you to tell me why you think that's not a good argument.
Well,
sounds reasonable.
Number one, there's two good, I'm glad you asked that question. I have two comments on that. Number one is we heard a plethora of presumptions, speculations. I don't have the evidence. I would infer as to how all this advertising hocus-pocus fits together. This wasn't a suit for an advertising tort. It was a suit for the unauthorized sale of these products out in Oregon. Where all this comes together in the record, other than, well, I presume, I hope, I wish it happened, I don't know.
In, I think, the Oregon opinion, which is what I read to you.
Well, there's the magic sentence, page 4, that I referred to, and there's a talk about how the white sleeve is handled, which is also at page 4, but there's none of this comprehensive, I read the ad, oh, yeah, that triggered in my mind, I would call this guy, and that would lead to the wholesale. From what I understand, this is a pretty small market that there's not people from all over the world. I mean, I don't look in time for old software I want to buy at discount prices.
But, Counselor, they must have seen something that caused them to call and ask, send me a sample.
Well,
they didn't do it just for no reason.
Sure they did. I've worked with you for 15 years. You've been sending me cases. Let's say this is an insurance company that's been sending me cases for 15 years. They think of me. They send me a case. This guy's been buying discounted software. Says, what kind of software you got? What do you got I might want to buy? It's not a thing where they're wandering about lost in the woods thinking, you know, where can I buy a car from? And they see an ad that says, go buy a car there, necessarily. And the bottom line is that there's no proof of any of this in the Oregon record that would support this kind of a conclusion. Other comments that I have very quickly, Justice Ziegler, if you look at paragraph 7 of the Court of Appeals opinion and page 29 of the Symantec brief, that was Symantec's position, and I understood their position to be that with respect to the copyright, the white sleeve argument would be the critical issue there. And I'm not going to go through the quotes, but I think that's what's indicated. There's a lot of, there's a comment about the injunction. The injunction wouldn't state a damage claim. I don't have the cases in front of me. I think the Johnson Control case is one that applies with respect to that. It's been cited in our brief with respect to that comment. With respect to, I guess the final comment I have, since I know my time is just about up, is there was a reference here to, well, what would a reasonable person, what would a reasonable insured think when they read this policy? And, gee, I think it ought to be covered. Well, but what was alleged?
Counselor, if you wanted to get Norton antivirus, and you go into a store in Madison that happens to sell this kind of a program, what do you ask for? Don't you ask for the title of the program that you want, Norton antivirus?
If I were smart enough to know what that was, I might.
Well, I mean, if you want to buy it, if you know, you want to put an antivirus, well, just pick any program that you want to pick.
Sure.
I mean, you may hear, when I was in private practice, I used to use PC Anywhere to get myself in and out of the office. And I just went out and I said, I like a copy of PC Anywhere. Well, isn't that the title of the program? I don't see why you think that titles shouldn't include what was listed in our materials here. The Norton antivirus, just take that. That's the title that's handiest in my mind at the moment.
Well,
why
the issue,
isn't that a title?
The issue comes down to whether or not, first of all, the advertising, all that, only applies to trademark infringement issues, not to copyright.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Second of all,
Norton antivirus is, I think, also trademarked, but go ahead.
Well, I don't know about that particular scenario. I'm just, the Court of Appeals decision indicated that, and I thought a disputed issue coming in here.
Okay, all right.
But beyond that, the question here with respect to, I'm losing track of this whole thing, I'm sorry.
Well, see, I was trying to talk about, I'm looking at the trademark problem, because
we'll
copyright
there.
Is listed and we're not arguing about that's enumerated. So I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at that it has to be enumerated, and I'm looking at the word title, okay? And Mr. Skilton's argument was, well, these are all labels for intellectual property. And so why isn't Norton antivirus the title sufficient to fit within the definition of the policy?
There's a split of authority around the country as to how that operates.
Right.
What has happened in Wisconsin is that the Fireman's Fund case says what it says about that.
Yeah.
And we can talk about broad and form endorsements and the pros and cons of what that means. But that footnote, and there are numerous other jurisdictions that support that position as well that are set forth in the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance brief in detail, specifically, I should say, at page 6, I believe. But that's some of the courts say what you're saying and some don't. And the Wisconsin court, at least from the Fireman's Fund case that I read, seems to indicate that this is not a state where trademark infringement is lumped into title. And my further position on that is, you know, why not just put infringement of trademark if that's what's going to be covered instead of going through all these mental gymnastics to get to that point?
Yeah, and that's why you gave us this handout where it's
exactly.
Now
I wanted to make sure,
sure
we had the language in front of us so I could keep it straight.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Bradley.
Thank you, Chief. Counsel, do we have to overrule then the Western Wisconsin water decision decided in July of 2007 that indicated that Wisconsin follows the Charter Oaks and that trademark comes under infringement of title for purposes
I think you do. I think, interestingly enough, that seems to go down the same track from the same district but doesn't mention our case in the Court of Appeals, which was a couple months before that. I think you do have to do that, though. If I have one last comment, please.
Quickly. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Please.
My only comment was Mr. Skilton kept referring to what a reasonable insured would expect. This stuff is referred to as pirated software. The loss is unauthorized sale. The Court of Appeals decision. In the Court of Appeals decision in the Oregon court, read that decision and see what they refer to it as. A reasonable person would not think this is an advertising injury claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson, and thank you, Mr. Skilton, for your interesting argument on what an insurance policy covers, but in a different format of trademark and copyright, which we don't often see, but have seen some. With that, we conclude our hearing in 06 AP 1153 and 1194, Acuity versus Begadia. The court's in recess until its next oral argument next week, and we will meet in closed conference at 3:15. Thank you.